Welcome to the Beyond the Shoe Box Score Podcast, where you hear from current and former Sacred Heart student athletes and coaches. Here's your host, Dan Gardella.
What's up and welcome back to the Beyond the Shoe Box Score Podcast. My name is Dan Gardella, here with you always for another episode of the podcast. Fifth one already. We have such a great lineup already done, lineup coming up. It's been great so far, and the reactions and the responses that I've gotten for this podcast have been tremendous. So once again, I always thank everybody who listens, who checks out the podcast and the interviews that I've done. And I'm just excited to keep going as we keep going throughout the year and get closer and closer to college basketball season. We're under 2 months now until college basketball is supposed to tip off. Right now, everything is so fluid where you count your blessings every day and you kind of just hope that we can get to that November 25th start date with no hiccups or any bumps in the way. And you know, hopefully we can get to a point where we can have college basketball and just kind of get back to some normalcy. So it's exciting to get through it. And coaching and scheduling has been such a huge thing that I know within Sacred Heart has been such a huge topic right now. And across all of college basketball, still continuing to sort out scheduling, preseason tournaments, all that kind of stuff. So it's going to be exciting. You know, every time more news comes out, you get more and more excited. It gets closer every day. Unfortunately, the NEC on October 1st reaffirmed their decision to cancel or postpone fall sports. So now we look toward the spring, and hopefully there's some possible scheduling that can be done with football and maybe some other fall sports for the spring to kind of make up for the fact that there won't be any sports in the fall. So that November 25th date is carrying even more weight, as that will be the first time Sacred Heart will have a sporting event in what will be, I believe, 9 months, almost to the day, pretty much, maybe a little more than 9 months, but it's going to be a long-awaited day in which Sacred Heart can have some sport participating again. And more news coming down this past week that the Connecticut Ice, a festival that was so great for Sacred Heart last year as they were the champions of the Connecticut Ice Festival last year, they announced that it would be canceled for the 2021 season, and now we look toward 2022 until that festival will take the ice at Webster Bank Arena again. So sad news once again, but from talking with CJ Maritola, the head coach of the men's ice hockey program, said it wasn't expected, or it wasn't not expected, I should say. It wasn't surprising news, and they just got to hope that they can have some sort of a season in the winter. I know they had already pushed back the possibility of hockey starting at a normal time. Maritola said possibly sometime in November, maybe December. He is optimistic, though, that there could possibly be fans down the road in the season at some point. But once again, all this is so fluid where you just got to take it day by day and see where the news leads. But anyway, we'll jump right into my interview for this episode. He is the all-time leader in assists at the Division I level for Sacred Heart men's basketball, with 730 assists over his four-year career as a Pioneer from 2012 to 2015. Following his basketball career at Sacred Heart, the Connecticut native took on the coaching reins and had a couple stops, and now is currently an assistant coach for the Merrimack men's basketball program, now a conference foe for Sacred Heart. So we talked about his time as a coach, his time as a player, and the weirdness of being an opponent coming back to Sacred Heart this past season. So without further ado, my interview with Phil Gaetano. Joining me now on the podcast is a former member of the Sacred Heart men's basketball program. He is the all-time leading assist leader in the program's Division I history. It's Phil Gaetano who now joins me on the podcast. Phil, thanks so much for joining me. When you hear all-time leader in assists at the Division I level for Sacred Heart, even to this day, what goes through your mind?
I think it just means I, you know, was fortunate enough to play with some really good teammates who, you know, could really put the ball in the basket. And I think equally as important, I played for some really good coaches who gave me and everyone else in the court a ton of freedom to just kind of play and be ourselves. And, you know, I think started with Coach Bike, and Coach Latina still does the same with those guys. I think the record might have gotten a little lucky that I still have it, since, you know, Cam left. I think he was on pace to break it, but I'll have it for a little while longer. But Coach does a great job, so I'm sure someone will break it soon.
I mean, and since you alluded to Cam, obviously through his first 2 years, he was on pace or very close to on pace to possibly breaking that record. When you did get a chance to watch him play, and we'll get into, you know, your coaching career, you know, what skills or talent did he have that maybe resembled your game or things that you did when you played at Sacred Heart?
I think the absolute first thing that I think was really, really similar and kind of unique even among some really good passing point guards is like our ability and our willingness to kind of throw the ball ahead in transition. You know, both of us got a lot of assists kind of throwing it over the top, and he was really, really good at that, you know, throwing it to Jarrell or EJ or whoever else, you know, might have been running. I think that was one thing. I loved watching him play. His vision was ridiculous. I think that's kind of where the similarities ended, though. He was much more, you know, downhill and fast and get in the paint and draw a crowd and find somebody. My assists were a lot different. I didn't go by a lot of people. I didn't spend a lot of time in the paint. They were kind of, you know, hitting people off screens or pick and roll, stuff like that. But I think his willingness to kind of throw it ahead, he was really, really good in Coach Latina's up-tempo system. And, you know, I'd like to think I was pretty good in it too. So that was pretty cool.
You know, when you look at college basketball now, and you know, you can credit the NBA for kind of starting this run and gun, jack up 43s in a game, and if you make more threes, you're going to have a better chance to win the game. How does that differ from maybe the style that how college basketball was when you were playing, when, like you said, especially at Sacred Heart, it was more screen and rolls, kind of more of a half court, work the offense, get a good look kind of thing?
Yeah, I would say it's a lot different just in terms of what people are looking for. You know, I think threes were still a big thing when I played. But like, I know for myself, I was a pretty good shooter off the dribble, and that wasn't even really a thing. Like, no one was coming off pick and rolls and shooting threes then. You know, it was a little bit, it was like a year or two before Steph Curry kind of started making that popular. And I think that's a huge thing now. And I think analytics have, you know, with KenPom, and I know it's been around a long time, and some other things, the impact of the three-point shot and then how many more people can shoot it. Like, we started to play small as I got older, where we had like four guys out there that could shoot. But now, like, you almost never see a team that doesn't at least have one through four who kind of shoot threes really comfortably. And sometimes even the five man. So I do think it's evolved, and it's not like I haven't played that long ago. I think I was maybe 1 or 2 years late. I would have loved, you know, to come off pick and rolls and shoot some threes, but it is what it is. It definitely makes basketball really exciting now.
Your first 2 years at Sacred Heart, you were coached by legendary coach Dave Bike. He retires. Anthony Latina takes over for your last 2 years. Was there any difference in how they coach the style? Obviously, Coach Latina has been around Sacred Heart for many, many years now. Did it seem like there was much of a transition, or was it kind of he picked up right where Coach Bike left off?
You know, honestly, it was pretty seamless. Coach Latina, obviously, at least for myself and really everyone else on the roster, was really, really involved in the recruiting process. So, you know, I think his relationship with the players was where it needed to be the head coach. And he was super, super involved with the day-to-day stuff, even when Coach Bike was there. You know, they have really different personalities. Coach Bike is a lot more laid back, a lot quieter. You know, he'll take you off to the side and kind of give you a talk or you know, what it may be. And Coach is a lot more animated and, you know, just not a beat. Coach Bike was in a good mood, but Coach Latina just is more animated about it. You really know. So their personalities were different. But in terms of how they ran the program, you know, I think they were both really similar. They wanted guys to play hard, and they gave guys a lot of freedom, and you know, I loved playing for both of them. I learned a ton of different stuff from each. So
what's the best story you have of when you were coached by Dave Bike?
My Coach Bike story. Oh man. So there's a million good things I learned. So probably the two best stories really quick. The first one is, the man is an absolute beast when it comes to food. So completely not basketball related, but I'm on my recruiting dinner and he got appetizers for the table, got his meal, whatever. I got like a steak dinner, I think, and ate like maybe half of it. Absolutely could not do this in a coronavirus world. But he like finished the rest of my steak after the appetizers, after his meal and all that. So that's one. And then the other one, and I use this story all the time because I think Coach was, you know, old school for lack of a better term, but just really big into like really appreciate what you have. And so I remember, you know, I think it was my freshman year. We got like two pairs of sneakers or whatever. And, you know, my first one I wore for most of the year and it started to rip. And I went to him and I tried on the second one and I wore it for like a day. And I was like, Coach, I don't really think these fit. Like, you know, is there any chance we can order me a new one? And he was like, try them again. And so like, I tried them again and whatever. And obviously broke them in and they were good. And, you know, looking back, like it was a good lesson. It was like, hey, appreciate what you have. You're a Division I athlete. You know, most people don't get any sneakers for free at any point. And he was really good about instilling like life lessons that at the time, I don't even think I thought about, but looking back, you know, are stuff that I really value. And like, I use that story with my players now all the time, whenever they have anything to say about gear or this or that or whatever. So neither of those is really basketball related, but I think that was the awesome part about Coach Pike is, you know, it was about so much more than basketball. So,
well, let's talk about your recruitment story a little bit more. I mean, you're a Connecticut kid from Wallingford. You end up playing for Sacred Heart, obviously staying in state. You know, was Sacred Heart a school that was on your radar for just from being in the state and playing basketball in Connecticut?
So honestly, not really. Like I knew they were and, you know, I knew, you know, rest in peace to Chauncey Hardy, but he played in the same high school conference I played in and he played there. So, you know, I knew of them from him. But honestly, I didn't have a ton of recruitment coming out of high school. After my 4 years, you know, Coach Kidd actually recruited me a little as a senior in high school. But no scholarship offers to Division I. I got a really, really late in the summer scholarship offer to Division II, but at the time I had already kind of committed to go to Choate Rosemary Hall for a post-grad year. And then Sacred Heart from there was the first Division I to offer me. And, you know, I don't know if I would have got any more offers or not, but I committed pretty early on, like right away in the fall. I fell in love with the campus and I had some friends who played with me in AAU who were already there. So that was big. And Coach Cecina, Coach Kidd, and Coach Pike, they were awesome. Like I couldn't have felt more comfortable and they made my parents feel really comfortable. So it was definitely, I mean, it was a really, really, really easy choice for me.
So you take a post-grad year, which, you know, in this day and age is something that is very common for some high school athletes who are looking to get looked at more by colleges. Sacred Heart, I think has begun a track record of finding kids who take the post-grad route. You talk about yourself, Sean Hohen, EJ Anasicki, Zach Rads, they all go to St. Thomas More. Anthony Latina picks him up. Sean Hohen becomes a first team all conference. EJ Anasicki goes to play at Tennessee for a grad year. I mean, what does it say? What does it say about Sacred Heart being able to go out and find these kids who are like yourself, under recruited, maybe didn't get a lot of offers, and then was able to turn them into players who had really successful careers at Sacred Heart?
Yeah, for sure. I think two things. I think Coach Latina, and his staff, but you know, certainly coaches, I think he is a really, really good evaluator of talent. You know, I think they all, you know, and Coach Kidd was the first one to do it with me. Coach Latino will tell you if you ask him, you know, he didn't love my game at first and that's fine. I had to, you know, kind of prove to him that I could play there. And but I think he really tries to and they all try to look at what guys can do and don't get caught up in maybe what they can't, you know, or maybe that they're small or, you know, in Sean's case, I'm sure people said not that athletic, EJ a little undersized, me undersized, not athletic, lots of not good things. But they really focus on what guys can do. And then I think the second part of that is, you know, it's easy to evaluate the talent sometimes. I think there's people that can do that. But then really being able to understand what makes those people good and putting them in situations to really highlight those strengths and really believing in them and giving them a ton of confidence once they are there to kind of let those things that they saw in recruiting really blossom. And you know, obviously it's led to some pretty good careers.
So right after your playing career at Sacred Heart, you pretty much jump right into the coaching scene. You start off at in the D League, or now the NBA G League, with the Maine Red Claws. You then come back to the college ranks. You were at Coppin State for a year before ultimately landing at Merrimack. Was coaching kind of the plan for you, what you wanted to do out of college, or was it sort of something that came out of nowhere?
No, I pretty much knew. I knew at some point I'd want to be a coach, probably from the time I was eighth grader. My dad has been a high school coach for like 25 years now. You know, it was something I definitely talked about with Coach Satina, even during the recruitment. My first coaching job was actually at Sacred Heart. I was a GA for a year. I think any player that tells you they didn't want to play after college is probably lying to you, like barring injuries or whatever. So that was the first thing. I wanted to continue to play, and I had some offers to go overseas, and I had an agent lined up. And just the more I thought about it, you know, I thought I really want to be a coach. Ultimately, that's my goal, is to be a Division I college coach. And I thought, why wait? You know, I'm going to get a start on it now. I'm young. I have a good opportunity here. So coaching was definitely always what I wanted to do. And I think playing for Coach Satina was really good in terms of he kind of, you know, he gave me a ton of confidence that I would have a chance to be good as a coach. And he, the way they run the whole program, like I loved basketball every day, which is not always the case, right? A lot of guys get to college loving it, and then by the end, for whatever reason, didn't have a great experience and don't want anything to do with the game anymore. And that was like the complete opposite for me. So I'm really grateful for that.
So talk about, you know, how you got in with the Maine Red Claws. They're obviously the minor league affiliate of the Boston Celtics. I mean, you come right in there. I mean, after your time at Sacred Heart as a grad assistant, you're in there and you're an assistant for the team. And usually that's a good pipeline for now NBA, you know, coaches to go into the NBA. I mean, how did you even get that in or that connection?
So it's a really just kind of weird story. Like I was fortunate. I think, you know, I think I did some things along with the fortune to cement the job, but honestly, it started Evan Kelly, who was my teammate. We both graduated from Sacred Heart the same year. He was part of a Celtics like pre-draft workout. They needed some guys and he went up and worked out for him. And Dave Lewin, who is at the time, he was like director of player personnel for the Celtics. He has a more advanced title, but he works in their front office and he was the GM of the Red Claws. He asked, I guess, all the guys at the workout, hey guys, like, is there anyone that works you out or you, you know, that's a young coach that's good with on the court stuff? And obviously Ev knew how hard I worked in my own game. And when the season had ended and I knew I wanted to get into coaching, I'd started working him out a little. So he kind of gave Dave my name, and that was actually before I even started the GA year. And then over the course of the next year, Dave and I connected, and I went up to probably like 5 or 6 Celtics workouts and practices, and you know, even ran a guy through a workout who played on the D League team. And so just through building that relationship and kind of showing that I was decent at least at working guys out on the court, you know, it kind of went from there. And then I was fortunate enough, they offered me the job. And you know, that was amazing in terms of learning about basketball and some other things. I mean, the G League is such a hard league to coach in. And my boss at the time, Scott Morrison, who's the head coach, he's actually like on the bench, on the front bench for the Celtics now. He was an unbelievable coach, and learning from him, being in Celtics training camp and learning from Coach Stevens, you know, that experience was something that I think really catapulted just my knowledge of the game and you know, things like that.
So after that, after you were there for one season before you go back into the college ranks, you go to Coppin State and end up at Merrimack where you are now. I mean, how do you take what you learn from being a part of a D League team and kind of going back to what we talked about earlier with knowing when you see talent? How did you incorporate your learnings at the D League level back into college to kind of say, this is what it takes to play professionally if that's where you want to end up?
For sure. I think one of the biggest things it did was, well, two things really. The first was it really taught me that recruiting and putting together a team is not necessarily about assembling the most talent, right? It's about assembling talent that fits together well and then finding the best pieces. And that was a huge part of the G League, right? Because there's talent all over the league and your rosters are constantly changing, but the teams that had the best pieces and the guys that fit together the best, were usually the most successful. And then I think the second piece was it gave me an even greater appreciation for basketball IQ and guys who really knew how to play. Because all the guys at that level, seeing the NBA guys, even like the gap between NBA and G League, but then G League between what I was used to in college, and those guys' understanding of the game is just at a totally different place, right? So like the NBA guys, it's amazing. Like you tell them a coverage, you don't even have to show them it. Like they can go out and they can execute it, and and their feel for offense and how to play. So, and then the G League is like a step below that, but still way above college. So it gave me a really good appreciation for, hey, this guy might not be the most athletic, or he might not be the best shooter or whatever. But if he has some basketball IQ, you can find a place for him.
So let's talk about you, where you are right now as an assistant coach for Merrimack College, a new member of the Northeast Conference. A year ago, they began competing in the conference. This is your second year with them. Your first year was almost as successful as your second season. Your first season, you guys are still in Division II. You're in the NE10. You are able to win the conference and go to the NCAA tournament. Kind of going back to your Connecticut roots, you're a Connecticut guy, you're coaching in Massachusetts, and you win the NE10 championship at the University of New Haven, obviously in New Haven, Connecticut. I mean, how surreal was that to, you had your playing career, high school and college in Connecticut, and now to coach and be successful at the same place? What did it mean to be able to do that?
Yeah, it was really cool. It was an awesome experience with an awesome group of guys. And obviously the championship game being at New Haven, my family got to be there, and they all got to see the game and celebrate with us after. So that was awesome. It was a real familiar area, which was nice. But to win a championship, like that was the first championship I had won since my prep school year. To kind of get back in that winner's circle and be part of that and be part of that group was pretty special. And then to have my family be there to see that was even more special. So definitely an awesome year and an awesome group.
So then after that year, you make the move up to Division I. And like I said, this past season, the 19-20 season, you began to compete in the Northeast Conference at the Division I level. I mean, there weren't high expectations for you guys making the transition. And I believe it was your second game. You go to Northwestern and you beat them in Chicago. And then you just continue to win. You finish atop the Northeast Conference in your first year. You were as stingy a defense as any college in the country. I mean, what worked so well for this Merrimack team this past year?
I'll start with Northwestern. That was unbelievable. Just 2 days earlier, we had gone to Maine and absolutely got our doors kicked in. We had about a 20-minute film session and maybe a 10-minute practice. The next day, hopped on a flight, went out to Northwestern, and just played a million times better. And, that's a testament to our guys. And like you said, it kind of carried on. And I think the biggest thing was we just, we knew we could rely on our defense, and that was huge. But we just had, we had guys who really had a winning way about them. They had won a ton of games, and I'll never forget, that was kind of what Coach Gallo, he was telling them in the Northwestern game as we're coming down the stretch, because Northwestern was really young. Like, hey, Javaris, Mikey, Jaleel, Devin, Dries, our five guys who kind of finished the game for us. Like, you guys have won over 70 college basketball games in your career. These guys have won zero. And at the end of the day, like, winning is winning, And so I think there's something to be taken from all those experiences. And we were able to kind of lean on that and play really, really hard. And we had a group of guys that really only cared about winning and wanted, to do it for the right reasons and for each other. And you know, luckily for us, it was enough to get a lot of wins and win the conference. So it was a really fun year.
And I know this was such a controversial thing. As we got toward the end of the season, you know, there's obviously the rule that when you transition to Division I, there's a period where you're not eligible for the postseason or any NCAA affiliated tournaments. Mm-hmm. When you have a season like you did last year, did you try and find a way to argue that point? Because you guys won, I believe it was, you know, 21, 22 games. You guys, this is your first year as a Division I team. You feel like you wanted to be rewarded. Was there any kind of internal conversations that you're going to try and find a way to make some sort of tournament?
No, I mean, we're going to play in the CIT, which obviously, you know, isn't the NCAA tournament. Not really, honestly. Like the way we looked at it is our reward was we had a great season. We won the regular season. We'll eventually get rings and we'll have a banner. And it was an awesome experience for everyone involved. And the rule is what the rule is, whether we think it's not fair or it should be different. Would we love to get a chance to compete in the NEC tournament and win it and go to the NCAA tournament? Of course. Obviously you'd always want to play more games and that's the biggest stage. But it was fun to see other people on Twitter kind of argue for us. And, you know, obviously we felt like we belonged with all those teams. But it is what it is. And I honestly, you know, you'd have to ask our players for their opinion. But from my point of view, it didn't take anything away from the season. Like it was as special a season as we could have. And we won as many games as we could win. And, you know, winning the regular season is honestly, it's harder than winning the NEC tournament. It was a fun year and a great group of guys. And you play this game for those relationships and those experiences and to win games. It doesn't really matter if those games are NCAA tournament games or regular season games or whatever. So it was, would it be nice? Of course, but it didn't take anything away from the experience.
So I believe the waiting period is 5 years. I mean, so, you know, when you're recruiting kids, you know, not many kids who can play Division I basketball want to go to a school that doesn't have an opportunity to compete in the NCAA tournament if you were successful enough. What is your selling point to recruits, you know, over the next couple of years to, hey, come play for Merrimack, even though, you know, best case scenario, you're going to be playing in a CIT?
Well, it's kind of not a super long answer, but the first thing is it's 5 years, but your first year is before you actually transition. So it was 4 years from last year, only 3 years now. It really only is a big deal with kind of that first class, because they're the ones who get penalized the most, obviously, if you want to call it a penalty. And basically five of those six guys who committed in that class committed to us when we were still Division II. So it wasn't even something that really came up a lot. Now, when it does come up, because we're honest, right? We tell people, we don't try to hide it. What we tell them is, A, if you're going to a school, right? If we're recruiting against another school, it's probably a Northeast Conference school, their chances of making the NCAA tournament are slim anyway, right? Like they have to win the NEC tournament. That's the first thing. The second thing is, you are going to base something that's going to impact the next 40 years of your life, right, or more, on something that may or may not happen, right, or like one game. And listen, I played college basketball. I get it. The NCAA tournament is super cool. I would be insane to sit here and tell you it's not. You know, my wife actually got to play in one at Sacred Heart, and I know how cool an experience it was for her. So I get it, but it's one game. And what we sell at Merrimack is the experience. It's not about, you know, the NCAA tournament. It's about the everyday experience, you know, the education you're going to get, the memories you're going to make, the amount of games you're going to win. And if you're selling one thing, you know, if someone's downplaying like, hey, they can't make the NCAA tournament, that's fine. That means they probably don't feel confident in what they do have to sell. And we're okay with that. You know, we want guys that really want to be there. And if that's a reason that they don't, that's okay. You know, we can find someone else. There's a lot of really good players out there. And I'll be honest, I don't think it's hurt us in recruiting one bit. You know, I think our freshmen last year, you know, were really, really good. And had a lot of impact on us being able to win the regular season championship. And, you know, I think our class that came in this year, obviously no games have been played yet, so we'll see. But yeah, it's, you know, we kind of knew going in that was something we'd have to talk about, but we were really comfortable in terms of answering that question when it does come up.
So obviously this year, you know, Merrimack was successful and Sacred Heart was right up there with them, breaking the Division I record for wins in the season. And you contributed to two of Sacred Heart's losses in the season. How weird was it for you, whether it was playing them at home at Merrimack or coming back to the Pitt Center as an enemy, essentially?
Yeah, so the our opening NEC game was at the Pitt Center. So that was weird. The weirdest part, 100%, was shoot around. You know, walking, because I hadn't even been in the gym in a while. So walking back in the gym and kind of shooting on the hoops that I played on, you know, that was definitely the weirdest part. And then preparing for the game. But I'll be honest, once the game started, it was a game, like, it was, they were the enemy and we were trying to do everything we could to win the game. Obviously, I want to win every game I'm a part of. I'm super competitive. So it was, I didn't feel bad one bit. But I never like to see those guys lose. You know, Coach Latina and Coach Kidd, Coach Papix and Coach Steinway, they're some of my best friends in coaching. And I talk to those guys, you know, every week. So obviously I don't like when they lose, but if it's a choice between them or us, I'm obviously going to pick us every time. So it was definitely different than other games, just the experience. But you know, once the ball goes up, the ball goes up. And both games were awesome games. You know, the one there was, it was cool because it kind of showed us, like, they were picked really high in the preseason poll, and we beat them, and that was like, all right, guys, like, we can do this. We just won on the road at one of the better teams. And then our game at our place was like national TV game, and the place was rocking, and it was awesome. So both games were a lot of fun. Obviously not as much for them, but
yeah. I remember I was sitting press row. I think it was for that first game against Merrimack, and obviously, you know, Merrimack, new school in the conference, don't really know a whole lot about these players. And I think it was maybe in the first 30 seconds, you know, you're in your typical stingy defense and you create, I think it was three turnovers in the first 90 seconds. And at that point I was sitting there thinking, you know, who is this team? Like, what's going on? And I think you had, I want to say it was maybe 30 something points off of turnovers. You know, you were stingy as anything. And at that point, at least for me personally, that's where my eyes opened up to, okay, this Merrimack team can, you know, run with these guys. And obviously when Sacred Heart played Merrimack over in Massachusetts, it was a much different story. You guys were, you know, you commanded once again from, you know, tip to the final buzzer. So that was, at least for me, that was the point where I kind of opened my eyes and learned who Merrimack was exactly. But I'll close with this. You know, obviously your path from player to coach can be a common one. You know, what would be a message for any player, manager, person around the game of basketball who wants to get into coaching? How would you advise them to do that as they continue throughout their career on either side of the basketball?
You know, I would say, I mean, to get in, you know, I would say just focus on whatever you're doing right now. So if you're a player, you know, if you're a manager, whatever it may be, focus on, you know, everyone talks about networking. I hate that term. I'm not very comfortable like going up to random people and talking to them. So that's not a big thing for me. My thing would be, you have to, if you want to call it network, you know, you have to do a great job of that where you are. So if you're a player, have a great relationship with your coach, have a great relationship with the people at your school, whether it's the administrators, others, whoever, right? Have people around you really say good things about you and think highly of you. And just try and dominate whatever role you're in, whether it's a manager or player. And then, you know, if you can remember that along every stop along the way, you know, I think that that's probably the best advice I would give. Like, I think it's hard to kind of, you know, people are always worried about what their next step is and what their next job is. And what I found is the best thing to do is just kind of try your best to dominate the one you're in and do the best in your role, right? And that fits for a player too, right? And I think that was one of the good things is being a player, is you kind of learn that. So just dominate the role you're in, build great relationships with the people you actually see every day, rather than trying to, you know, go on Twitter and message random people. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. And some people are more outgoing than me, and maybe they're better at it than me. So maybe for them that does work, but just, you know, make the big time. I think there's a book, it's called like Make the Big Time Where You're At or something like that. And it's really true. You know, that's kind of been my what I've tried to do. And I've been fortunate. You got to have some luck. I'd be lying to you if I said you didn't. But just do that and keep learning every day. And, you know, I think from there, things will kind of take care of themselves. I think people will, you'll be someone people want to be around and want to work with, and the word about you will get out.
Thanks for your time, Phil. I really appreciate you taking some time to talk with me. It's always great to talk to a former Pioneer. Best of luck in your off-season workouts as college basketball starts to pick up. And, you know, hopefully we'll be able to cross paths again soon in the NEC.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you having me, and I'll be the biggest Sacred Heart Pioneer fan. And I don't know, I'd say 29 games. I don't know what it is this year, like 25, but I'll be cheering for them, and good luck with everything you got going on. I really appreciate you having me on the podcast.
Yeah. Once again, thank you to Phil for hopping on the podcast. Once again, I mean, Sacred Heart basketball has a lot of tradition, a lot of history, and Phil was really a part of the team when the men's basketball program had that changing of the guard. Obviously, his first two seasons, Dave Bike, the legendary coach Dave Bike, had his last 2 years coaching the Pioneers before Anthony Latino, who was a longtime assistant under Bike, stepped into the head coaching role. So he got the end of the first era of Sacred Heart basketball and the beginning of the next era, which even continues in that to now, is Anthony Latino. I believe it's his ninth season coming up this year. So, you know, lots of history there, and to be able to talk with somebody who has one of the records at Sacred Heart, it's always good to talk. But that'll do it for this episode, episode 5 already. Once again, and I said in the beginning, I'm so thankful to everybody who's been listening, who's been responding to the interviews that I've done, and the response that I've gotten have been very positive. So I always thank you for that. On next week's episode, we are joined by a current member of the Sacred Heart football team. He was the first underclassman to surpass 2,000 career rushing yards. Julius Chestnut, the preseason All-American, joins me for episode 6 to talk about his recruitment journey to Sacred Heart, his time at Sacred Heart, and what he hopes to accomplish in the last 2 years of eligibility. But that'll do it for this week. Thanks again for listening. Until next week, we'll see you next time.